A leader who finds out new information must change his or her position. That's what I'm doing.
Governor Parnell vetoes a popular bill that passed the legislature. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 3rd of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the National Guard breaks ground on a new facility in Bethel.
The airborne operation is pretty spectacular. The community's going to be able to come out and watch their soldiers jump.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Governor Sean Parnell announced today he's vetoing an expansion for Denali Kid Care. The program provides health care to low-income pregnant women and children in Alaska with a combination of state and federal funds. The legislature passed a bill last session that would have increased the income guidelines for participation, allowing more families to sign up for the program. The law passed with broad support, and even Parnell backed it. But he says he changed his mind when he realized the money funds abortions.
I know that there will be a lot of disappointed people. I'm disappointed, frankly, in what I found. But I oppose expanding government funding of abortions, and I oppose expanding eligibility where that is created. And as a matter of public policy, I'm saying that I cannot do that and will not do that.
Lawmakers estimate the expansion would have funded health care for at least 1,200 more children and more than 100 pregnant women. Anchorage Democrat Senator Bill Willikowski says he was shocked by the governor's veto because of Parnell's long history of support for Denali Kid Care from its inception under the Knowles administration. Willikowski says he was unaware that abortion funding was allowed under the program until recently. But he says even though he has concerns about public money being used for abortions, lawmakers often pass legislation that they consider 90% good.
This is a case where the bill does, I think, a lot more good than harm. And it's, again, providing insurance for thousands and thousands of children and pregnant women. And I don't think that's something that we can overlook. I mean, are there going to be calls now to end Denali Kid Care? I mean, I guess that's sort of the logical conclusion of what Governor Parnell is saying. I'm surprised that he would support Denali Kid Care at all at this point.
Willikowski says the bill passed with strong bipartisan support, 16-3 in the Senate and 37-3 in the House. He says that may be an indication that lawmakers should consider a veto override.
This will cause children and pregnant women to not have health insurance, and that's not good for our society, to have pregnant women who are giving birth without the potential of having medical care available to them. I think that's a very dangerous decision.
Anchorage Republican Representative Mike Hawker voted for the expansion. He was also surprised that Governor Parnell vetoed the money. Hawker says when Parnell took over as governor, he indicated a desire to boost Denali Kid funding. Hawker says, although abortion funding may be abhorrent to some, it's important to consider the greater good that Denali Kid Care provides. But he says the program is part of Medicaid, which allows funding for some abortions.
There is no easy answer for it. In a purely philosophically pure approach, we'd probably eliminate the entire Medicaid program. But as a political pragmatist, I don't see the state being receptive, the people of the state of Alaska as a whole being receptive to us eliminating the entire Medicaid program based on the relatively small amount of money that's spent on abortions each year.
Hawker says Medicaid spending in Alaska is more than $1 billion each year, with more than 50% of those funds in excess of $600 million coming from the federal government. Clover Simon is a director with Planned Parenthood of Alaska. She was dismayed by the veto. She says low-income families don't have any other options for health care.
I think that the governor is using this as a political issue, and I think that that's the most disappointing thing, is that he would put health care for children across Alaska on the line for his own personal political beliefs about abortion.
She says under Alaska law, state funds can only pay for abortions that are deemed medically necessary by a physician. Federal Medicaid pays only in the case of rape, incest, or life endangerment. Governor Parnell made the Denali KidCare announcement as part of a press conference where he signed this year's budgets into law. He vetoed $336 million from next fiscal year's operating and capital budgets, but he left untouched the rest of the $13 billion in spending the legislature approved. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Governor Parnell focused his vetoes on the capital projects budget. It had left the legislature spending $3.2 billion. Parnell said the state is in the enviable position of having a surplus available now, but he said there are warning signs that we will have to cut sometime. And in talking to other governors from around the country, he said the only way to avoid the financial troubles of other states is to target spending.
They have states in financial trouble in part because when times were good, they kind of took a let the good times roll mentality or attitude and overspent at that time. And Alaska is going to take a different approach. While times are good, or while we have a surplus in this case, we are going to make targeted, smart investments, both to take care of what we have as well as to build new infrastructure.
His response was to cut $300 million from that budget, mostly from increases the legislature added to what he proposed at the start of the session, and mostly in a wide range of small projects spread out around the state. He says he talked to 54 of the 60 legislators about the projects in their districts before making his decisions on what would remain. Parnell points to what he left in place. Infrastructure, such as highways and water projects, resource development, public safety, education, and maintenance. There were only two large statewide vetoes, $25 million in grants for the renewable energy projects, and $22 million for a rail extension to Port McKenzie. Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker, co-chair of the House Finance Committee, noticed that the cuts were mostly in the form of reductions in spending, partial funding of projects instead of removing them completely. And he says that means supporters of those projects will be back.
The needs haven't gone away. The needs for improved roads, the needs for improved water system, the needs for these community projects have not gone away. But again, we've in that mode of deferring our spending. This is the same challenge that government got itself into in the decade of the 90s.
In the 90s, at the time of low oil prices, the legislature said it needed to make drastic cuts to its annual spending. Hawker says the high budgets of the past few years have mainly been catching up on the needs that were bypassed then. And like the governor, he says at some time, the economy will get tight again.
As the cycles go, we're going to be very tempted again to go into a mode that we don't fund things immediately, but that it will come home to rest when we have to pick up the pieces.
The Senate's finance co-chairman, Bert Stedman of Sitka, also says the needs will be back, most likely next year. And while the cuts were substantial, there was really no fiscal reason for them.
We have projected to have about $12 billion in savings at the end of June, not counting the permanent fund. So the interest alone will be larger than this on just our savings. So, as we try to move the state forward, a lot of these projects need to come back on the table in the next appropriating cycle or the one thereafter and continue to move forward and get built.
The legislature could still call a special session to override the vetoes, but Stedman says it would be difficult under the circumstances, since about half of them are at the local level and there are not likely enough in any one place to justify such a move. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a farm in Iklutna works to bring back an Arctic mammal that vanished from Alaska.
We're actually working to domesticate the muskox, and the end of that is them as a sustainable northern form of agriculture.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The state reported a new large fire in the Delta Junction area yesterday. Fire Information Officer Pete Buist says the Big Swede fire had already burned 2,000 acres when it was identified in the vicinity of the Gills Creek fire.
The visibility has been so bad over the last few days. There's so much smoke laying in the valleys from the existing fires. It had grown quite a bit before they actually discovered it.
So far this year, 293 fires have burned nearly 464,000 acres. The state's biggest wildfire has combined with a second blaze. Buist says the 133,000-acre Toklat blaze southwest of Nenana has burned together with the 17,000-acre Jeans Creek fire.
In the world of firefighting, that's not necessarily a terrible thing. It actually can slow the action on the front of the upwind fire that moves into the burned area.
Thunderstorms have helped slow the Gills Creek fire north of Delta Junction. Fire Information Officer Tom Lavanino says showers dumped varying amounts of moisture on the 18,000-acre blaze.
None of that was sufficient enough to put the fire out, but it was just mitigating the fire intensity, so the fire is not so aggressive and we can get crews in there safely to operate and construct fire line.
Hundreds of firefighters aided by bulldozers and air support are working the Gills Creek blaze, which has threatened power lines along the Pogo Gold Mine Access Road. The horned, long-haired muskox, once plentiful in Alaska, was so overhunted that by the mid-19th century, it vanished from Alaska. Efforts to bring back and to domesticate the gentle animals began in the 1950s with a few muskoxen captured in Canada. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, a Palmer farm now provides a safe home for a growing herd and its seven new babies.
Yes, a little bit.
All right, well, have you
fashion-conscious Alaskans can find unique and very warm knitted winter wear at Umingmak, an Anchorage shop on a busy downtown street. But where does the lightweight yarn called Kiviut come from? Literally off the back of a 700-pound muskox bull named Papaya. Nick McElroy is an interim director at the muskox farm in Palmer. He's watching as three interns pull the undercoat from Papaya using a long-toothed comb.
It's a part of our project. We're actually working to domesticate the muskox, and the end of that is them as a sustainable northern form of agriculture. We're exclusively concerned with harvesting their Kiviut. It's also incredibly valuable.
The Kiviut comes off in thick, matted chunks, leaving long, silky black outer hairs on Papaya's back. He's impatiently stamping his hooves, although most of the adult muskoxen there are used to the procedure. The woolly hair the animal sheds is spun into yarn at an East Coast facility, then shipped back to Alaska. Women in western Alaska villages like Bethel and McCuriuk knit the yarn into garments using unique Alaska Native designs. Nick shares interim director duties with Quill Teal Sullivan, who is the granddaughter of John Teal Jr., the anthropologist who was the first to advance the idea that the muskox could be domesticated.
We by no means at this point have what we'd consider a domesticated herd. You know, you think of cattle or goats or sheep that have been domesticated for thousands of years, and they've been bred for, you know, certain purposes. So we still have a lot of experimenting, trial and error, research to do, and we still have a lot of that wild DNA. We have really intelligent, curious animals, which is part of the delight of the muskox.
The animals on the farm are treated more like pets than livestock. Many are bottle-raised. They have personalities and names like Luna or Papaya. Two 2-year-olds named Shagaluk and Safety snuffle their snouts through the fence, curious as to what these human visitors are doing. At present, Kiviut is the only product of the farm. After it is cleaned and processed, the yarn is sold to the Umingmak Cooperative, which supplies the knitters. The garments they make are prized and command high prices. Not so long ago, when muskox herds that once roamed the north were decimated by Eskimo hunters hired by whaling crews to provide meat supplies, by 1845, there were no musk oxen in Alaska.
A lot of them will walk right up to us.
Hello. It's been a long road back for the fuzzy, goofy-looking animals. 60 years after Teal started his experiment in taming them, the herd in Palmer is doing well. On a pleasant May morning, a walk through one of the pastures on the 77-acre farm is a treat.
Come on, boys.
Nick shakes a bucket of muskox feed to attract the animals. He says the animals represent a challenge to animal husbandry. They have to be carefully monitored for weight, illness, kiviot production, and myriad other things. Their hooves have to be clipped regularly, too.
We handle them a lot. We're going to weigh every animal once a week. It's great for monitoring their health because they have so much hair. We can't tell if they have an infection or there's an abscess or an open wound or something.
The farm is owned by the nonprofit Musk Ox Development Corporation, although the actual musk oxen are still owned by the Teal family. As with any farm, meeting the bottom line is a challenge. Nick admits money is a constant concern. Hay, for instance, is expensive. The farm makes a little money on tours during the summer, but kiviot is the bread and butter crop. In a 15 to 20 year lifespan, a musk ox can produce a lot of kiviot.
7 pounds a year, so in a lifetime, the muskox can produce huge, huge quantities of kiviot and a lot of value. And that's one reason why raising muskox for their kiviot is, in a way, much more like sustainable and valuable than, you know, killing them for one-time use for their meat. If we can get like over $10,000 of kiviot in a lifetime of an animal, that's much more than we would for if we sold them for meat, which just isn't part of our vision really at all.
That vision could mean muskox farms in, say, Kotzebue or Wainwright. Nick says that's a possibility, but in the far distant future. Meanwhile, musk oxen calves, 7 new ones this year, chase each other under the watchful eyes of their mamas, oblivious to any human cares. They'll thrive here and grow up to contribute their shaggy hair to make hats and mittens, in their way knitting Western Alaska into the fabric of a successful commercial enterprise. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The National Guard in Bethel is going airborne. Construction has started for a new Guard headquarters in the Western Alaska city to support the new mission. Local Guardsmen hope the change will bring more jobs and more career training to the region. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
Like most longtime Guardsmen, Francis Utahiuk has spent his 25 years in the Alaska National Guard as an infantryman, but no longer. Now the Queetluk resident is the acting first sergeant of the Bravo Company Airborne Division. He's already received his airborne patch, but his training is not complete.
I have to go to jump school, which is 3 weeks.
By jump school, Utahiuk means he'll be required to jump out of an airplane. I ask him how he plans to deal with that.
Once I go to jump school and do my first jump, that's when I'll find out.
Utahiuk is one of about 130 guardsmen in the YK Delta being retrained with a new focus. The Alaska Guard was first established to block a threat from Soviet power during the Cold War. That threat has diminished, but until recently, the Alaska Guard remained part of the National Infantry. Now the Alaska Guard is aimed at becoming more mobile so that they can quickly respond to emergencies or threats of terrorism. That effort has led to construction of a new readiness center in Bethel, Brigadier General Thomas Katkus.
You look across the whole spectrum of what we do at the National Guard, this facility in combination next to an airfield is critically important and very relevant to all of the different conditions that our soldiers will be faced with now.
Katkus was one of many that attended a groundbreaking ceremony on Tuesday afternoon. Standing in the top story of the Guard's hangar, Katkus looks over the rolling tundra. He appears giddy as the new site below is prepared for construction.
I expected to see it at some point in time, but when it's here, it's still always surprising, especially on a sunny day in Bethel. It's just gorgeous to be out here and see this facility get started.
The Readiness Center will be constructed to accommodate approximately 75 troops, and not just local troops. The Alaska Guard has typically trained and operated on its own, but a new strategy to nationalize units will mean that Alaskans will be training with units from Texas and Rhode Island.
They're affiliated now with a much larger unit. So that unit, just as we will go to Texas or Rhode Island to train, both of those states will come here to train also.
Katkus is hopeful that the new kind of training that occurs around Bethel will increase the Guard's visibility and the community's interest.
An airborne operation is pretty spectacular. The community's going to be able to come out and watch their soldiers jump. They're going to be able to watch the aircraft come in and move soldiers from point A to point B. The community is going to be much more involved in a facility out here near an airfield.
The Readiness Center will cost about $16 million to construct. Most of that comes from the federal government, and about 25% is coming from the state. Building in rural Alaska is expensive, but Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell says it's necessary.
To centralize the National Guard in one area would not work to actually bring in all the soldiers we want. We want soldiers from Bethel. We want soldiers from Kotzebue, Nome, Barrow. We want soldiers that are outside of the urban areas. So you have to have the facilities in the area where the soldiers live and work, because the Guard's a part-time job.
The emphasis in training airborne ready troops should bolster skill sets that are in demand in Alaska. Not only will more Guard pilots be needed, but mechanics to work those planes. And the Guard will begin training military police officers in Bethel. Katka says at times they could assist with local law enforcement efforts.
Their primary function is to train and be ready for their federal mission and to support the state. So there'll be requirements at times that maybe they mobilize into a state mission where they support local law enforcement and or bring their tools, equipment, and technology to bear in support to the civilian communities.
The military police training will also open the door to women in the region. Females are excluded from duty in Guard infantry.
The military police, however, is male and female. So a much broader based community, also military police having a relevancy to the community. Law enforcement is always sought after here in Alaska.
The Bethel Readiness Center is expected to be complete by summer of next year. It will be one of three main headquarters, with the others in Anchorage and Juneau. Guard officials will now push to create a fourth center in Nome. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The traditional summer for Alaska Native youth centers on the family fish camp and a chance to absorb culture and learn new skills. But that doesn't mean Native youth staying in Anchorage this summer won't be honing academic skills in a culturally familiar environment. KSKA's Len Anderson has this report as part of our series on Native education.
Title VII Indian Education Supervisor Doreen Brown is excited about her program's summer offerings.
We have something for everyone. We have lots of things going on this summer.
The Title VII webpage of the Anchorage School District shows a half dozen possibilities. They're obviously popular. All but one is filled. The longest-standing Title VII summer student attraction is the Enrichment Program. It's for first through eighth graders. The pair of two-week sessions are completely filled with 150 students each, plus a waiting list. The students will have physical education, math, reading, writing, cultural arts and music, and language classes.
Right now at our summer enrichment, we have beginning Yupik and an intermediate Yupik that will be teaching Unangan, Thinkit.
Brown says this year, Title VII has a separate gender-based summer program for preschoolers.
Project Hala, and that's a Dena'ina Athabaskan word for boy. And this is a two-week camp for boys that are going into kindergarten.
The pre-K transition masculine group runs during the last half of July. It's the only summer Indian education program that still has openings. The Title VII supervisor says the summer offerings, like its programs during the school year, arise from parent, student, and staff suggestions, as well as performance data pointing out needs. On the high school level, Indian Education is offering a chance to take algebra and English courses within an individualized approach.
Under Project Buhitut, we have a variety of online courses that our high school students can take. They may want to get ahead by taking these courses that are online, or they may just need some remediation or credit recovery.
Buhitut means smart person in Chupik. The Title VII Indian Education student programs and projects are federally funded and do not derive their budgets from Anchorage School District revenues. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Celebration 2010 is underway. Southeast Alaska's largest Native cultural gathering kicked off this morning with the grand entrance parade along Juneau's Willoughby Avenue. KTOO's Casey Kelly was there and has this audio postcard.
Long time ago, the people of Alaska were wonderful people. They were strong enough, they were able enough, they had strong willpower, they had a strong spirit, and they survived through the ages. And we are here today as descendants of the people of Alaska.
All of you, wherever you came from, you're making a ripple today to make a difference, so that young people can remember you came together. Remember, you're the voice of yesterday. You're the voice of yesterday, and you're the voice of tomorrow.
Ancestors have always taught us to say that we have owned and occupied southeastern Alaska since time immemorial.
The sounds of Celebration 2010, gathered by KTOO's Casey Kelly. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Eklutna, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson also reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.